To the Blind Students of California and CCB Rehabilitation Committee joint meeting. Is Ed Crespin here yet?
No.
From the Rehab Committee? Okay. All right. Well, hopefully folks from the Rehab Committee will be a part of this as well. I know Tricia's here, and she's part of the Rehab Committee. Anyway. My name is Linda Porrell. I'm a member of the CCB Board of Directors and Press San Francisco chapter, but I also have the privilege of being the board liaison to the Blind Students of California. And because the Blind Students President, Lena Bandy, is unable to be here today, she asked me to moderate this discussion, which we hope will be both lively and constructive. So I'm going to give a brief introduction of our panel, and also make some apologetic remarks about some questions that we had in advance, and then we'll get this show rolling. First, I'm going to introduce Joe Xavier, but I'm not going to say too terribly much about Joe because he had a most impressive bio that was presented yesterday. He's a deputy director for special needs of the Department of Rehabilitation. Good morning, Joe.
Thank you.
Can I say a couple words? Okay.
Thank you, Linda. First of all, let me thank you guys for inviting us here. And I received a call from Donna a number of weeks, or seems like probably months ago by now. When you get my age, months and weeks start to blur. And Donna said if we would be willing to come here and have a panel for the students, and said, you know, the only thing that I was uncertain of was whether, you know, my schedule would permit me to be here if I was able to be somewhere else. So once we clear that up, we're very happy to be here. We look forward to, as Linda said, a very active dialogue, and to hearing your questions and hearing your concerns. And to those that we can speak to, certainly do that. To those that, you know, need to be thought through a little more, we'll certainly be doing that. So we'll look forward to the discussion.
Okay, thank you, Joe. And next to Joe is Catherine Bales, and Catherine is the program manager for Blind Field Services for the Department of Rehabilitation. Please welcome Catherine.
Okay, I just wanted to say hi, and we're really happy that we can sit down with you today and talk about your school issues. And looking forward to having a really nice discussion with all of you.
Thank you. And to my right is a person who's familiar to many of us in CCB. Used to be a great generator of resolutions for us on the Resolutions Committee until she got promoted to supervisor at Department of Rehabilitation Blind Field Services in the Oakland office. Welcome our friend Patricia Leeds.
It's nice to be here with you all, and I still have the same heart and spirit for you all, so don't worry, I'll show up at the room every once in a while.
She does. She was with us late last night. So, all right. Now, as a prelude to this, over the last few months, Lena was encouraging people to submit questions, and the sort of guidelines for questions were that they be somewhat general, not necessarily specific to a particular case, but that they dealt with an important issue facing a student dealing in their negotiations with the Department of Rehab or seeking information from the department. So that is our formula. We want questions that are kind of open-ended and address the larger picture. Now, some questions were submitted, but Lena was unable to come at the last minute. I was unable to reach her, And so Tricia informed me that Catherine might have those questions with her, or that they or
I remember too.
And Tricia remembers them. So let's see if we can generate one or two of those, and then go to use them as a guidepost, and then go to the audience, see what people have to add to that.
Okay. I could recap some of them if that makes it easy.
Sure.
Okay. I remember seeing one that was about, you know, why can't we get ongoing support? Why couldn't we get ongoing canes or maybe other ongoing needs that we have as people who are blind, maybe computers? That is an ongoing need for us all in life. And I thought that was an excellent question. And why don't we just go to Catherine or to Joe to talk a little bit more about, you know, how we serve people at the department.
Or we can let Tricia start.
Oh, I could be happy to take it. Okay, you know what? Okay, we had a lot of thought, and me and Catherine had gone back and forth. We had prepared a lot about just thinking about things, but. Why don't we give ongoing support? Because we want to make sure that you are up and employed and making money so that you can go on with your lives and just support yourselves. And yes, you know, that is just a philosophy in our country and then, of course, that, you know, throughout the United States. But over, like, say, maybe in Europe, they might do ongoing supports like that throughout people's lives. But you know what they don't do? They don't help you get employed. And that, to me, is a slap in the face, because it really says, I don't believe in you enough. It says that I'm not going to invest in you enough so that you can stand on your own two feet and make it economically and pay for your own things in life. And anyway, that's one of the reasons why we don't do ongoing support. It'll help you initially to get off the ground, and that hopefully is so that you can get a good job and pay for things on your own. And it's hard to know that when you're really young, to understand that. As I know, when I was young, I was like, well, you know, why can't you have that forever? So it's actually a very good question, because I was very confused about it when I was very young too.
It also would, one of the things that I think would be beneficial for the students, if you don't already know this, we have post-employment services. So you come to the department, you work with a counselor, you complete your individual plan for employment, you're now successfully employed. You've truly began and enjoying your own independence. But something comes up that says, hey, you know, I need some post-employment services. There's nothing that prevents you to come back to your counselor and say, hey, let's talk about post-employment services. So that's something that's yet available to you as you progress. And, you know, circumstances change in our lives. Things can come up that we don't anticipate today, frankly. They do quite often. And so your case was closed, you were successfully employed, and something came up that, you know, may risk you losing that employment, or, you know, your employment terminated for some other purposes and you now need services again. You are not precluded from coming back to the department and having your case reopened so that you can get those services that you would need to again become successfully employed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you both. Could I ask sort of a follow-up to that, sort of underscore one of the issues that might occur, and we see that at the Lighthouse sometimes with folks coming in, is their vision condition progresses downward, and they need another round of orientation mobility or some other additional, they need to move from Zoom text to JAWS. So those are conditions under which they might apply.
And I just wanted to say that as we work with our students and as they become employed, and of course that is your goal and it's certainly our goal for you, we just want to make sure that you do understand that, yes, we want to close that case because we're excited with you and we want to celebrate you for getting that job that you've been working so hard for. But once that case is closed, Jill said it, I'm going to reiterate it, that your case can be reopened when there's a need, and you just need to contact your counselor and say, I've got a need, things have changed, and we will be glad to sit down and talk with you and find out how we can work with you. You know, Department of Rehab, we're not supposed to be, what do they call that, cradle to grave? But at the same time, we are to help our consumers, to help people with vision loss to achieve the goals that they need to have for their life at work and independently. So living independently. So as things change, as circumstances warrant it, then we want to talk with you too. Okay.
Okay, that was good follow-up here. Another question that I saw was about why are cases being closed so quickly? And I don't know the specifics of it. I'm sure there's more to this story. But sometimes it's really important for everybody to understand that follow-through with your case, when you write a plan, when the plan is written and you sign it, and the counselor signs it, and everybody signs it. Following through is extremely important. And if we lose contact with people, the case will get closed. Now, you can reopen, just like Joe and Catherine said. So it's, you know, not bad. But, you know, we try to close cases, too, once you're up on a job in 90 days. Now, I know that's not the case for a lot of people who are blind, and many people who are blind have jobs that are, you know, high levels, and there's going to be some scripting, there's going to be some changes in some software coming down the line. We might want to just hang in there just a little bit to make sure that you're up and going, because we also do know we perceive some post-employment coming around the corner as well. So we just kind of say, in this situation, it's a little sensitive. We don't want to, you know, ruin anything for this person. We want to see you retain a job. That is extremely important. So that's a little bit to that question about you guys.
So I think the really the important question is, why do we close cases at all? Why don't we just leave it open? You know, which kind of goes back a little bit to the prior question. And it's beneficial for you guys to know that under the statutes that provide us the money that we can support your employment, your individual plan for employment, there's a number of conditions, and we won't go into all that because it'll take all of the rest of the convention and then some. But one of the things that our department is obligated to do is to report on an annual basis to the Rehabilitation Services Administration how many, what our caseload look like. And one of the numbers that RSA very much looks at is what were your successful closures. So if your case or your predecessors or people that will be coming after you, if we never close their case, that number might look like a big goose egg. And that would not endear RSA or the policymakers in terms of funding this program. So closing your case is truly a reflection of success, not just for you personally as an individual, but, you know, for the department and for the policymakers that support the program.
And I wanted to say that for many of our consumers, they're on Social Security benefits. And you may not know this, but as we close cases that are from consumers receiving Social Security benefits, as a 26, we call that a 26, when they've gone to work, when they are achieving their SGA, they call it, then we receive a reimbursement from Social Security Administration. And we all know the budget situation. It's not just in California, though, either. The budget situation is critical all over the United States right now. We need those funds. We need those funds so that we can continue to serve you later, so that we can serve the consumers that we have. So budget is an issue, but we have to have that case closed before we can get that reimbursement. And it takes quite a while before that reimbursement comes. But if you really are working, then yes, that's the thing to do. We close the case, and we can reopen it later if there's a need. We can do post-employment services. And just so you know, that a post-employment service case situation is not reopening the case. It's a way in which we can provide a necessary service to that consumer for something that is not complex and short in duration. So it could be from providing some equipment. It could be providing some more O&M training. It could even be for some more job development and placement services. But we try to keep those services very, very non-complex. You know, that is, it's going to be over in maybe 6 months to a year, maybe less. So those post-employment services are available, and they really do help that consumer, whoever, to be able to continue with their work.
All right, thank you. I think we've sort of got the ground rules. Foster Brown's going to be running the mic, and perhaps we should begin by just going around and seeing who's in the room. Please give your name, where you're from, if you're associated with a particular CCB chapter or the Department of Rehab, let us know that. And we'll just get a sense of who's here. And then once that's done, we'd like to begin taking questions from those of you who have them.
Okay, Artis Bazin. I'm president of the Glendale Burbank chapter. I live in Burbank. And I was a student. Got my master's in 1998, so not too awfully long ago.
My name is Anthony Daly. And I currently attend Kenyatta College in Redwood City.
Good morning, Richard Retta, Director of Community Services at the Lighthouse in San Francisco, former DOR counselor and a member of the San Francisco chapter of CCB.
And a good former counselor, yay!
Hello, I'm Tommy Lucier. I work at the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco as a participant in the Blind Leaders Program.
Hello, I'm Jessa Drury. I also work at the Lighthouse for the Blind as an intern in the Blind Leaders Program. I have an open rehab case, of course, as well. I just recently graduated, well, not too recently, from San Francisco State with a psychology degree.
Hi, my name is Alice McGrath, and I am from the Silicon Valley chapter. I work for Vista Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, and I just joined the CCB Rehab Committee.
I'm Lisa Gordon. I'm in the Golden Gate. I'm the secretary of the Golden Gate chapter. I live in San Leandro, and I graduated with my master's in counseling in 2005.
Okay. Hello. Yeah, this is Michael Peterson, and I'm a first-time attendee to this convention. I came with my wife, who's a member of Sacramento chapter. I just graduated SDSU, have a master's in rehabilitation, and a CRC, but I'm looking for work. So anybody hears of anything, let me know.
My name is Brenda Trevino. I am from Merced, California. I just joined the CCB chapter, the Yosemite Gateway chapter, and I was recently nominated as secretary in that chapter and voted in. And I currently have an open rehab case. I am going to college there at the junior college, majoring in child development.
Hi, I'm Silvana Rainey with Adaptive Technology Services.
I'm Leslie Gibbons with Sterling Adaptives.
Hi, I'm Juan, a member of the CCB delegate for the HCB Capital Chapter, and I'm a newly elected vice president for the Blind Student of California. Thank you.
My name is Therese Gardner. I am a member of the Rehabilitation Committee, and I also am a counselor for Blind Field Services out of Modesto.
Hi, my name is Benna Kim. I'm the rehab supervisor at the Department of Rehabilitation, and I was a former student a long time ago, too.
Sandy Handy, rehab counselor, Stockton area.
Kate Del Ross from Petaluma, interested consumer.
Mike Del Ross, I'm here for continuing education for my state guide dog license.
Good morning. My name is Debbie Bacon. I am currently finishing up my final year of my master's program in rehabilitation counseling at San Diego State. I'm going to be doing an internship with Trish Leitz in the Oakland office, which I'm very excited about. And I am a member of the Rehabilitation Services Committee.
This is Brian Bash, and I direct Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco. And for students interested in closing their cases, I urge you to check our website for some upcoming positions. Mm-hmm. And also, if you're interested in being a counselor or a volunteer or counselor in training at our Enchanted Hills camp this summer, there may be a spot or two left, so come see us.
And lastly is myself, Foster Brown. I sit on the board of directors for CCB. Former president of the Inland Empire chapter of CCB, outgoing vice president of BSC, and currently my rehab case will be closed next month. Ed Crespin was my rehab counselor. And I ended up getting a position in Oakland at the federal building. I work for the IRS. So I completed my case. Thank God.
Oh, we are so happy for you. Congratulations.
Introductions.
Good morning. My name is Donna Pomerantz, and I'm president of the California Council of the Blind, and I reside in Pasadena, California. I am a private consultant. But what seems to be taking up most of my time now is my volunteer work as CCB president. So welcome to everyone who's here today, and I'm looking forward to hearing a great panel.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Questions?
Yes, back to those. Okay, so...
No, we'll take their questions now.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there was one on procurement I remember, and there was another one I couldn't remember how it was phrased, but I remember the answer I was going to tell you guys is make sure when you do, if you do have a job or know somebody who has one, please tell them to keep it, and we'll come in services to help them retain it. That seems to be one of our biggest issues, and I just want to make sure that we spread that word everywhere we go, because that's the scariest day when someone comes in and says, I left my job, and I need your help now.
Yes.
So, anyway, do you want to just go up to the questions in the audience, or what do you want to, okay. Mm-hmm. Or what do you want to do, John?
No, I think it's great.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think it'd be great. I'd love to hear from the audience the questions they have, and whoever can recall what the procurement question is, ask. If Tricia doesn't know the answer, we'll go find out. So,
my sense of the procurement question was the concern that's been raised recently about whether you were going to go to one bid for all services, you know, all technology services. And so I think it was dealing with that issue, which I understand is under reconsideration. Is that correct?
So let me speak to that a little bit. If I'm understanding that correctly, you're talking about what we call the state price schedule. And essentially, the state price schedule was a vehicle that was put into place many years ago to expedite the procurement of AT for state employees as a reasonable accommodation, and then was also being used for the procurement of services or products and services for our consumers. Back in the 2005 era, the governor signed an executive order to make the state of California a model employer for persons with disabilities, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we don't hire enough persons with disabilities into the state workforce, and we'd love to see more of that. This past July, the governor signed another executive order that emphasized providing timely and appropriate reasonable accommodations for civil service employees. So a lot of work began on how to expedite that process, because what occurred over time is DGS, who is the control agency over the procurement process, introduced into the state price schedule more and more and more restrictions. So this past fall winter, the issue really started surfacing around the state price schedule, and what was being touted was to shut it down. And so we said, no, hold on, you can't do that. And you certainly can't do that now without anything to replace it, because we rely very heavily on that. We spend some $9 million in volume through the state price schedule. It's not just chump change. And a couple of our partners, actually Sylvana and Leslie, who were sitting here, came to us and said, hey, we need to talk about this. This is a real issue. So we began conversations with them. We had conversations with CCB members and others around these issues with the state price schedule. The result of that was a number of conversations with the Department of General Services. Those conversations have not been as fruitful as we would like, but we haven't given up. We still continue to work with DGS because, as I said yesterday, our objective is to get every blind and visually impaired Californian that wants a job. And accommodations, AT products, whether you are a student completing your IPE or somebody who has a job and getting those services and that reasonable accommodation need met, we need to make sure that happens as quickly and as timely as possible. So while we have discussions going on with DGS, and we'll continue those discussions because we're not an organization that just takes no at the first glance of that, we also have engaged our community partners in exploring what might be other options available to us, because at the end of the day, it's the Department of General Services that has a control over that price schedule. And while we are very involved with them to make sure that they're doing the right thing, we're also wanting to make sure that we don't leave any other stones unturned. And we began exploring other avenues that are available. For example, fair and reasonable, which allows procurement under $5,000, and small business, which allows procurement over the $5,000. And I'll forego a lot of the detail unless you guys really want to get into the minutia of procurement, which can put us all to sleep in a hurry.
Joe, this is Donna. I also wanted to say for the audience that related to CCB having those conversation with DGS, we were basically told that we need to work with Department of Rehabilitation, and Department of Rehabilitation will keep us in the loop of everything that's going on related to the issues with DGS. So we were basically told that whatever would happen would come through the Department of Rehabilitation. So just letting you know that as well, that
wow.
DOR is the one who will be letting us know, which is why, Joe, we're having the regular meetings with you and Director Sauer and Ralph Black to let us know everything that's going on and the progress of things. We did go to all of our legislators and let them know that we had concerns. We sent out our resolution and a letter letting them know what the concerns were, and phones started ringing off the hook after legislators received our materials and our concerns. And the meetings that we had were told, and we let Director Sauer know that, and Ralph, that DGS has basically said that we need to trust that the Department of Rehab would completely and totally keep CCB in the loop as to everything that's going on and such. So, I don't know if we need to touch base with our legislators again. Obviously, those discussions will continue, but just letting the audience know how things are going from the CCB perspective on that.
Yeah, thank you, Donna, and I think you and your representatives and I will have to have some more discussion about that. So as I said, we began exploring some of those options. But one of the things that I want to, you know, parallel to what Donna is saying, that we are very mindful that we bring discussion to the table, and that when solutions are identified, unless we're precluded by statute to engage in those dialogues, our style is to reach out and say, okay, here's where we've arrived, and here's why we are here. Let's talk about this, and how does this make sense or not for our meeting the community's needs, as well as meeting the requirements of the civil service processes that we have to work with. So in a nutshell, that's where we are. Is it resolved? No. Do we continue to work on it? Yes. And we will continue to work on it until we can find a solution that's, you know, workable and makes sense for all of us. But I think the important part, the two things that I think are very important to keep in mind here, are number one, getting more individuals employed, and then two, providing the timely services and accommodations to the individual. Because getting a job and waiting 3 months, 4 months, 6 months for your AT equipment, that's just not right. Yeah. That doesn't work. And trust me, internally, we have quite a dialogue about the need to expedite that. Just as an example of something, so you guys know what our, you know, our perspective in reaching out, we've now identified the need to replace a number of Braille displays within the department, that some of them are as old as 14 years old. The good news is they last. The bad news is they've lasted too long, because software now doesn't work with those old displays. Well, our first step was to reach out to our users and say, let's talk about this, and how does this work? What are the things that you, as users of Braille displays, need for us to consider as we move forward with this? So.
Questions? And I wanted to bring up that we really are so concerned about getting our procurement process expedited as much as we can. In fact, we had a meeting the other day with Joe and some other staff from different sections of the department just to talk about what's working, what isn't, what are the practices that we need to follow, where are they not being followed consistently. We want to know. We reached out to all of our supervisors. They reached out to their units to find out, where are you having problems? What seems to be the issue? So we really are, it's not only working with DGS and following those regulations, which we do have to follow, and staying at the table with them, but we want to know what's going on internally, and is there something that we can help to resolve so that we can get these items, this AT equipment that's so necessary. When one of our consumers who's a student is ready to go on to college, has left high school, now ready to go on to college, we need to have that equipment ready for them so they can go right on to that school and start doing and competing and learning at their fullest capacity. And that AT equipment is vitally important for it to be there for them. So we're trying to look internally, too. What can we do? Where are the areas of problems? Let's get them corrected.
From being a former student myself, one thing I know too is that as a student, Ms. Lee said before, it's a contract. And as a student, you need to do what you need to do. So, if, you know, when you know you're going to school, you need to let rehab know as soon as possible so that you will have that equipment, you know, the time when you start. Start taking classes, because, like you said, otherwise you cannot compete with the other students mm-hmm. in the class, and you fall behind on the syllabus with your, you know, your assignments and your reading and stuff when you don't have the necessary things. So it's the one thing that I try to tell young people that are getting services is to make sure you meet your end of the contract.
Questions. Good morning. This is Richard speaking. I just have a question for the counselors and for those who are current college students who's in their IPE. They have the ability to get textbooks. Is the more and more textbooks are becoming available electronically for iPhones, iPads, and other electronic devices. Has the procurement around textbooks, electronic textbooks, been expedited, or has it been slowed up with more and more textbooks not being available in print in the bookstores but online?
Okay. Richard, who are you asking?
Anybody. Students and counselors.
Okay.
Students and counselors.
Oh, hold on.
We got some people in the back here that might be good, better at this. Okay.
I found that it is fairly quick to get my textbooks. I don't get them online or, you know, download them anywhere. I buy my textbook at the beginning of each semester, and the alternate media person in the DSS office will put that into MP3 format for me, PDF format, whatever format I would require. And it is readily accessible. In my experience, I'm not sure about in other places, but as far as at the junior college in Merced, it is really working well there.
Okay, I have to do this. A shout out to Merced because I'm from Merced County, Gustine. So.
Hold on, we got one more hand over here.
Hi. This is sorry for my voice, guys. This is Therese. I'm a rehab counselor, and to date, I have not had any requests from my consumers regarding electronic books on the internet. Of course, I always refer them to Bookshare and Recording for the Blind and NLS. However, my boyfriend works at a state university, and he actually had a project this week where the faculty is exploring online materials, e.g. electronic textbooks, rather than using the bookstore. So I do think this is a very timely topic and that we all need to work together to address it so we're not all ran over at the last minute. Because as we know, many of those websites, those electronic books, are not totally accessible. So,
Cindy Handy, also a rehab counselor. What I've found in my area at Delta College, they eliminated their whole disabled student services and then brought it back. And the people that they brought back did not have experience in putting them in an alternative format. So I've really been encouraging my students to try to get their books, the list of their books this semester before the semester, so that they can have time to look for the alternative format as ebooks, or have the time for this person to be able to put it into alternative format. So I know it's an extra step for you guys to do that early, but it really helps you in the long term to be able to do that.
Jim Lozano with Service Students with Disabilities, Sac State. The one thing I'm finding now that's becoming a big thing is students are renting their books. And that is somewhat of a challenge for our alternative media specialists with copyright issues about the renting. And we are working with that, but it is a copyright issue, and it's going to become bigger and bigger of renting books. So I just thought I'd bring that up, too.
Gene and Donna, if I could just take this opportunity here. If either Gene, from your perspective, where you're sitting, you know, in from the college, how the college is looking at this, and Donna from the organizations, if there's a need for us to have a more focused discussion on this e-textbooks and the renting textbooks, because, you know, obviously we provide some of that for the students, I'd welcome that opportunity. I think Therese is right. I think too many times sometimes these issues come up and we're not, you know, as ahead of it. And frankly, I would think we're all going to say that we need another work group. Well, if it's for the right reasons, we better make the time for it. So if either you or Donna, you know, or others from your perspective see the need for us to sit down and have that conversation, I'd welcome that opportunity.
This is Debbie Bacon. I'm a little bit of a different student because I do my education online, and my courses are 12 weeks and 3 weeks off, so there's a very, very short turnaround. And what I think is needed generally across the board, whether it be a junior college, a university, online, whatever, is that as soon as you can get a book list out, you can get a publisher's and phone numbers, it really behooves you to call the publisher directly and speak to their person who does the acquisitions. A lot of times you have to educate them as well, but they're very cooperative. I was able to get a full textbook. I love the book. I started writing back and forth to the author because I love the book, and he sent me chapters that weren't even published yet in the proper format. So it, like they were saying, either, like Foster was saying earlier, you really have to do your share of the digging. And unfortunately, that's just the way it is. The media we have, there's so many options available. There's a lot of resources. Unfortunately, maybe part of this group discussion could be a way to collate all those resources into one kind of database or website where people can click on and get everything that they need to find out what format that textbook is available and how many options are available and where they can be purchased from.
I wanted to ask, actually there were two questions. What I call back in the dinosaur days when I did alternate media. I always used to encourage my students to go to the campus bookstore. Make a friend in the campus bookstore. And that is a great way to find out a semester ahead of time what books are going to come out for the semester to come. It was great. It worked well. And the student really needs to assist in that, being proactive. And from what I'm hearing, it sounds like what I encouraged to be applied back in the dinosaur days still applies today. Feed your people in the bookstore, you know. Bring them a Twix or whatever. I'm trying to help the vendors here, too. So I'm wearing all my hats. But I think that that is absolutely imperative. And to the issue of a database that all the, you know, where everything is located, I know that the UCs and the CCs were working on a project, and I believe they have something up where when you work with your alternate media specialist, they do have access to a database statewide that has textbooks in all different formats and such. So that is also something. But from the rehab counselor perspective, I think it would help a great deal. And I'm glad you want to have this discussion. It would help a great deal if we do have this discussion, because the barrier that students had, and again, if what I'm saying doesn't apply now, please let me know. But the barrier that students had was because they didn't have a printout and because they didn't have, you know, the official listing from the bookstore of said book, or because they received the information from the professor even before the bookstore had it, then they weren't able to get assistance to purchase that book ahead of time if it wasn't already produced. So we definitely do need to talk, and looking forward to that.
Sure. Hold on. Here we go.
Hi, it's Gene. I'm going to only talk about it from Sac State's perspective, and I'm certain that this is going to be appearing at other schools shortly with the budgetary cuts. And the bind the students are going to get into. Our campus, in the last 2-3 years, the class schedule went on the campus website, and a directive was given to faculty that they had to, by a certain date, turn in the titles of their books. And we got maybe 50% compliance, but that was pretty good. And that would be so when you were looking at your schedule and looking at, and still this is true, but if you look at the courses, you would see the books that are required. And that would help you make some judgment call whether some students are figuring 2 books versus 10 books. Okay, I'll go with the class with the 2 books. But the thing is, we're having that with the cuts. Departments are not even to right now for fall, are still trying to decide who they're going to choose as a faculty member to teach the course. So you look at the schedule, there are no books listed. And they're saying the faculty are going to make the judgment call. And my office has been putting pressure on the chairs of the department saying, you need to make a decision on the books because we need a turnaround time, especially if we're going to have to do entire Braille textbook version. Okay, and there's a point to this whole thing, but this, so you got the challenge there. The students can't immediately find out the titles of the books. For the fall classes, a lot better than when it's trying to do for the spring. But they come into with the department rehab, and rehab says, we'll get you an authorization to get your books, but you have to get all the titles of the books, and you better get it at one time, and then we'll issue something so you can go to the bookstore to purchase. And so the catch-22 is they can't provide titles, and then they get toward the beginning of the semester. And yes, you know, the alt media people jump through hoops, find from the different databases, the electronic ones, but we do have some students who need, because of their disability, Braille. And so that takes months there. So, yeah, there's need to dialogue, but this is going to become worse as all the schools and all three systems are not going to know until almost when school starts who's going to be teaching in there. And unless there's something really putting pressure on the departments that they're going to have to make a decision in advance, even if they don't have instructors, they're going to decide what the textbooks are, which faculty are going to balk on that because they're going to say, we want to have the freedom of choosing the books for the classes and not somebody else since we're going to teach the course. So it's a big problem. It's going to only get worse with this financial problem we're in with the state. Thank you.
I want to respond to that in two ways. One, I was on the President's Council for Disabilities at Fresno State, and we were addressing that already because I'm dyslexic also. So I had to all have alternative format, and what we suggested is that the department head pick the books, and that teacher just have to deal with those books, you know, so that we could go ahead and get it in alternative format because of that situation. Secondly, I think that's just a counseling style that you're talking about having to have all the books, because I know for me personally, when I get a list of the books, if there's additional books, I will do the additional books, but I get the initial list, and I'll do those, and then I'll do additional books. I may be doing it wrong, Catherine. Am I doing it wrong? Okay.
I'm Tuan Nguyen. I'd like to give you a pretty good experience that I have about 4 years ago when I'm taking a class at pre-calculus. I get my book really late due to the fact that Department of Rehab did not get the book on time. And I got the book in, and it took like forever to get the book in Braille. And I was falling behind in class for so long that I could not handle. And so I had to drop the course, unfortunately. And this is the only W I had on my transcript. And I wasn't feeling very happy about it. I usually don't want any, you know, bad thing on my transcript, but that is the thing I had to do. So, and I deal with it. And I, from that experience, in subsequent years, when I take calculus and higher math level, and in addition to my physics book, I get all the material way earlier as far as soon as possible, like 3 or 4 months prior to the start of the semester. And that it really helped a lot. On the other hand, for non-technical books like novels and things like that, I always independently scan the book. I had the school cut up the spine, and I take it home and the open book and scan it independently. And the nice thing about open book feature is it had an audio save. You can save it in WAV format or MP3. We did really great, and I put it on my Victor stream, carry it around with me anywhere, and have it both in audio and in Braille format, and have it in my Braille note, and I had all different things, and it's really wonderful, and that's something I recommend all the students here and all the counselors here to recommend the students what they can do to overcome the challenges they have and without falling behind in class unnecessarily and to succeed and to compete with other students. Thank you.
Yeah, I actually had a quick question. It was about renting books, and I think from what I understood, it was kind of like a problem. But why is that? May I ask? Copyright.
So you're asking that question. Why is the problem to rent books? I don't know. Gene, can you speak to that at all? Okay.
Hold on,
because I have no clue about copyright. I got to tell you.
Yeah. Just like music. And I'm not directly involved. So my understanding, the issue is with AB 422. That's really started in California. That. The university is supposed to have verification of purchase of the print book and then working in alt media, and that's working with the publishers. The publishers insist that, okay, we want to be certain that the print copy has been purchased and that so that the ownership of the book is the student narrow. Okay, the thing is, when you rent it, who actually owns that book? The bookstore has these books and then rents it out. So is it, you know, and to get it, the question is the, does that ownership from the bookstore carry over to, that student who's renting it? And so that our people can then produce the alternative media. And so it's an area that, they're looking at it, but it's like downloading the whole thing of music. They want to be certain that somebody has bought the print copy and they can get their royalties on it.
Bottom line, it's a money issue, because a lot of times, I know as a student, if I didn't have to buy a book, I would borrow a book from my friend and use it for that quarter if they weren't using it that quarter. Because, I mean, let's face it, even with the budget, even before the budget got really bad, in order to save some money, I was a math major, okay, so a small book would cost $300, and rehab only gives you $500, okay? So if I got one book that's $300 for that quarter, and then I have another book that's $200, and then another book that's $200, you see, I've already went over the $500 that was allotted.
Just
for that
so you know that we can go over $500 too.
Going to say that too. I want to make that real clear.
Normally, I just got $500, but also realized too, I could save some cost if I network with other people
and exchange
books and whatnot.
Okay, but I do want to make sure that everybody understands that kind of our usual is $500, a bank draft for $500 to buy books and supplies, books. But if there's a need to go over that, and we all understand how costs have gone up, all you need to do is tell your counselor, and that can be adjusted. We are certainly able to provide our students with the books that they need to have.
They'll give you a supplemental bank draft for that, or also M&T, another check for that.
Mm-hmm. Here's you know how students have become have learned to survive too, and things there. You buy the textbook, You get the purchase receipt, you go to the Disabled Student Services office, and you show them the receipt and say, see, I got it here. The office makes the copy of the receipt. Okay, it's been purchased, all legalities. Then they go back to the bookstore and sell it back. And they pocket the money. And that sometimes they use the supplement to buy books later on for other courses. And that is a loophole that the Department of Rehab doesn't realize, I think, that that's something. There's no checks and balances on that one. But it's survival. And yeah. The students are not feeling that they're getting enough support in the number of amount of money they can get. And that might be totally incorrect, but it's a myth that they have, at least that's the belief.
I'd like to speak to, I'm hearing an issue here that's apart necessarily from books and bank drafts, and that's a bigger issue that unfortunately, until Gene becomes president and changes some of these laws, and I don't mean president of CCB, I mean president of the United States. Right, no offense to Donna, but he's going to need some power to make some law changes. One of the things that occurs is we have a lot of processes in place, and I think a lot of times there's some transference of policy, for lack of a better description. So as an example, there is a policy that we cannot issue a bank draft for more than $500.
Oh, okay. But you can issue extra.
But somebody took that concept and said, we can't get books for more than $500. Two totally separate issues. Right. Here's the message that I want to make sure that I communicate to everybody. Don't get stuck in the minutia, because it is too difficult as a person who was outside of government for many, many years and then got to go and see how government functions. I think that one of the biggest challenges is understanding the mechanics behind all the stuff that needs to happen. And I don't encourage you to become versed in that, because you lose your hair like I'm doing, and that's no fun. But keep a very simple concept in mind. When you're getting an answer that just doesn't seem right, you need to feel empowered to say, this doesn't sound right to me. I need to ask. If you're asking, and the person who is just flat out saying no without even thinking about it for a second, that should be your cue to ask the next person. Yeah. You need to feel empowered to do that. We want you to do that. And do I think that our staff are saying no for fun? No, I'm not. But you know the confusion that you're experiencing, and we have Sandy and Therese, who are counselors, and we have two supervisors here, Kim Bennett and Trisha, and they'll all tell you, I mean, we have 2,000 staff across the state. Do sometimes we misunderstand a policy? Uh-huh. Do we do it intentionally? No, we're not out there doing it intentionally. So, yeah, I mean, I think if there's a takeaway from this session for you who are students and those of you who support students in their work, don't be afraid to ask. Do not be afraid to say, I'm not getting this, folks. This isn't making sense to me, and I do need this book. And yes, there are people that are doing a little more than they should, but you know what? By and large, the people that are out there want to go to work, get their jobs, become independent, take care of themselves, families, homes. That's the American dream. Those of us who swam the Atlantic, that's why we came. So,
That kind of segues into a question I was going to ask. I often get asked from either chapter members or others that aren't part of the chapter, what happens if you get a counselor that doesn't seem to work well with you? Either there's personality issues or you just don't feel they're giving you the answers that you need. Is it okay to change, ask for a different counselor?
Okay, I'm going to talk on this, and then I'm going to call on Bennett and Patricia. You know, we're all people. We have different personalities, and we want to make sure that we're counselors and first, and we want to make sure that we are communicating fully with our consumers. Once in a while, there could be a conflict. We all go through that with one person or another over our time because we're all human. If there's really a significant reason that you need to have your case transferred, you need to, number one, talk with the supervisor. The supervisor will be very happy to talk with you and try to resolve what the concern is. It may just be a misunderstanding. It may be something that's more serious. I don't know. There's all kinds of reasons that are out there, and I've heard, sometimes I think I've heard them all, and then I pick up the phone and I hear one more, and that's fine. We want to have a good working relationship with our consumers. We really do strive for that. The one thing, transferring cases, if it's not working, I guess one thing that I kind of keep in mind when somebody, sometimes it comes to my level, that they want to have a different counselor, and you have to think about, we're all heading for work. Every one of you in here, most of you, want to go to work. When you're working, you may have a supervisor, you may have a coworker, or just somebody down the hall, down another cubicle that, you just don't click with. Working with a wide variety of people, personalities, can begin with your rehab counselor. And you know, when you work through situations with your rehab counselor, when you use those good verbal communication skills that you're learning, that we've all worked hard to learn, when you're able to do that, you're going to transfer those skills over to your new job. You're going to be able to work with a supervisor that you go, oh my gosh, where did that guy come from? Or gal, you know. Sometimes I walk out of Joe's office going, what the heck? No.
And she is not kidding.
And sometimes I hear Joe Smith down the cubicle area. Anybody know Joe Smith? Yeah. And I shake my head and I go, I can't believe he said that. But you know what? We're all co-workers, and we all are here to get the job done and to the best of our ability. And it takes my saying yes sir to Joe Xavier and saying oh well to Joe Smith. I go, Joseph? Anyway, it takes that kind of give and take, and that really, it begins. Don't expect your rehab counselor to just, you know, be that person who is just going to do everything you want and say and what have you. There could be some difficult times, and you're going to have to learn to work through them, talk them through. But I want to really echo, too, that contact the rehab supervisor if there really is a serious concern.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we do want to be there to help work it through. We may not transfer the case. We may be able to get that case situation resolved. The other thing is that, you know, all of our counselors have very high caseloads. Most of them do. And, to transfer you over to someone else, well, now you're dealing with another counselor who has a high caseload, or now they've got to get all kind of caught up with what your situation is. And so, you know, I don't know. It may end up causing a delay or two, and I certainly don't want that for you. So trying to work things out the best way you can with that current counselor may be the best solution. But I'll let Tricia and Bennett talk to that.
Catherine, you said it well. I mean, the truth of it is we definitely would love it if you could work it out with the counselor first and try your best. And yet, if not, to make sure you contact us, because we can work through it. We can sit down all together and work it through. And my experiences are is that in the end, we all work it through. And that's been, I've only done this position for about a year and a half now, but I've had maybe five situations like that. And we've all just sat down, and they remained with the counselor, and things got better. One person called me just the other day and said, that's it, no more. And so I'm going to transfer that situation, because I think it's not healthy for both at this point, and it's better to make the switch. But that's not common. I'd rather try to work it through initially, because we just don't have enough manpower to just keep switching people either. We're down some staff right now, but really, we do want to work with you as well. And just, you know, how do you know how to get a hold of me? How do you know what territory I cover? Do you guys know what territory I cover as a supervisor?
Yeah, exactly. So, California. But, so, you know, if there's a way we can work with all of you to make sure we can disseminate that kind of information, and that would be something we'd like to do so that, you know, consumers have more access to that. I know we did a best practices session last time and working with Alice McGrath on it, and Alice was fantastic in helping putting some of the things together from that were key issues to better communicate with consumers. And I'm going to leave it back to the rehab committee and the new chair to work with that issue to resurrect that whole best practices that CCB members put together. So we do want to communicate as best as we can.
Could I intervene?
Oh, Bennett wants to.
Yeah, I'd like to have Bennett.
Yeah, please
chime in. She's one of our new supervisors, but she's also, that means that she's been a counselor more recently too. And so she's seen it from different perspectives.
No, I think you guys do a really great job. The same thing. Whenever I receive the phone call, the case transfer, I always try to work it out together first, work it through. But if it doesn't work it out, then yeah, I will consider another option. But you know what? Sometimes I see my role as a mediator between the counselor and the student, consumer, because sometimes this is a communication issue. So I'm trying to get involved. And another thing, you know, when I was a counselor, I always try to empower my consumers. Now, worst thing you're going to hear from me is no. So try out. Ask me. Because I don't know your situation until I hear your concern from you. So I'm happy to listen to any concern you guys have or anything. And also, one thing I just make a comment. Jean from Texas State University, I'd like to talk to you after this meeting because I supervise my counselor in Sacramento. If there's any issue, I try to work it out with you. So please see me. I'm blind. I don't know where you are at. So I'm here in the back.
I'd like to take advantage of opportunities. Foster?
Yes.
You're here. Can I use you as an example? Would you be insulted?
No. No. I'm 43 years old. I'm not too much you can do to insult me.
I'm not going to test that. And I just use that because Foster shared with us that he's about to become a 26. That means he's employed. When I have a new employee, no matter what position they're in, the first thing we'll do is spend 2 or 3 hours talking. And one of the first questions that I ask every new employee, and this catches them really off guard. I don't know why, but they just get totally like, uh-huh. And the question is, tell me what you're going to be doing in 5 years. And they're like, I just got here. I don't even know what I'm doing tomorrow, let alone 5 years. Here's my point, and I think this really speaks to each of you. So, Foster, what are you going to be doing in 5 years?
I'm going to be a lead in 5 years. And retire in 20s and start my own business as a enrolled agent where I can actually represent people as a tax professional.
Excellent. So what I'd like to share with you, Foster, is whatever I can do to help you get there, you let me know. The other thing that I'd like to share with you is your beginning, your interview. You are now being interviewed for your next job. And you have no idea who's going to hire you. You have no idea what that job is or where it's going to be. But you are today being interviewed for that job. So the email that you send, the phone call that you respond to, the phone call you did not respond to, the tone of voice that you used, that's part of your interview. So I'm picking up on the point that Tricia and Kathy and Bennett are making, when you have counselors or professors
or whoever, you are being interviewed for your next job. And there's no time like the present to start building that toolbox. Okay? Does that mean that you have to say yes when no is appropriate? No, because that's part of your interview. Somebody's watching you and going, you know, artist just seems to say yes all the time. I don't know if she can cut the mustard, you know. Did I not pick a good example?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, oh yeah.
But I mean, I really think it's important because a lot of times we get stuck talking about the mechanics of things. And we don't realize that in all of our life's experiences, it's a teaching moment for us as individuals, us as communities, and it took me some 50 years to figure that out. So look, I just saved you at least 30 years. So,
I'd like to elaborate a little bit. There's just been wonderful and instructive comments from our panel and their cohorts today. I just want to focus on, I mean, Joe, it's just, you're just knocking them out of the park today. So the first one, No, this one I want to go back to is the one you said, if something doesn't feel right, say something about it. Now, there's a tremendous amount of research going on these days, and books are coming out about trusting your gut and sort of knowing what your feelings are and so on and so forth. So this is just, he's got his finger on the pulse of something here. And I'm thinking that in terms of identifying when something doesn't feel right and finding the appropriate strategy for presenting that to your counselors, that's the kind of thing, project that it would be great for, I think, the Blind Students of California to develop some training and some guidelines around so that we can assist people in getting their needs met so they don't end up locked horns with their counselors in a session, in a mediation session with Tricia or Bennett, but that they get the issue resolved a lot earlier. Now, I'm going to go to a question. And you're talking about things not feeling right. It sort of prompted me to think about a discussion we were having last night in resolutions. I want to bring up the topic of funding of college. And since this information I got last night was new to me, first I want to be put on the correct path of what is the actual policy, and then, all right, so what I'm talking about is, do you guys have a policy that you fund a student at a community college level for the first 2 years of their education, sort of no matter what, and if they want a four-year college, they have to submit a special request for that. If that's the case, how do they go about doing it? If it's not the case, you know, what are some of the guidelines that you actually use for deciding on the amount you're going to invest in a student?
Great question. Mm-hmm. Let me set the context a little bit and then speak more specifically to the answer to the question you're asking. There's always two aspects to these types of discussions. There's a policy aspect. And then there's the piece that unfortunately always comes with it, which is the fiscal, the money. So one of the things that public policy always seeks to do, and sometimes better than others, but ultimately the objective is to balance both. So in the California Code of Regulations, it does say that the least expensive option is used for the services. And I'm speaking very broadly here. I'm not quoting the regulation. We can have that finer discussion at some other day where we can sit down and digest the verbiage of each. But essentially, that the least expensive option is used to meet the need. So if a student coming out of high school is going to pursue higher education, and which, by the way, I encourage every single person to do that, the least expensive for your general education would be a junior college. The regulations do go on to say that when that is not appropriate for the student, that there provides a mechanism for an exception. So what are some of those examples? Well, let's see. I live in Gustine, and there's no junior college where I am. So now I need to move to Modesto to go to a junior college. And the cost of going, living Modesto and going to the junior college is really the same cost that I would have had going to Sac State. All right. So that's one consideration. We have right now in Blindfield Services, I think we have 4 or 6 students that are enrolled in a 4-year. Mm-hmm. So here's why they're in their 4-year. Yeah, they're freshmen, sophomores, and they're in the 4-year. So here's why they're in the 4-year. They got full scholarships. So we're saying, great. It's, you know, 4-year, and we provide the support, you know, the books and the other supports that we would otherwise would provide. You know, at the same time, when you look at this issue, the question is, okay, well, you have junior college, you have the state colleges, you have universities. Frankly, you have Ivy League. Okay, I mean, I would, you know, I don't know if Yale or Harvard ever looked at me with any kind of seriousness, but, you know, being that I'm from Gustine, you know, let's face it, Harvard and Yale were not in my mind. But I think, so I point that out as a, really when you're looking at this issue, ultimately what ends up occurring is that there is, you know, a balance between providing the services and providing the services that is most cost beneficial, because the other thing that we need to remember in this grand scheme of things is that you're balancing those resources. And so if the Department of Rehab has supported me to go to Yale, you know, whatever cost that might have been would not have been available to provide services to another student. Now, the other thing that I think is very important here that I want to step away just from this particular issue, you know, these policies sometimes evolve over time. And events, circumstances, the environment has also changed over time. So let's not be hesitant about, one, questioning the policy, and two, saying, hey, is there a sufficient change from the point that this policy went into effect where we should step back and take another look at it? Right. Is there new information available to us as a community today that we didn't have all those many years ago when that policy was put down that we should reconsider? I personally believe that we should always go into revisit those policies. So, and it sounds like we may have an opportunity to do here, which we'll look forward to.
Excellent. I got one of the students wanted to ask something.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so this is a text, it's like regarding textbooks, community college and DOR, all in one, nice. Anyway, I brought this question or concern to my DOR counselor, Suzanne Tierney, but I was hoping that you could give me a more insighted explanation. So let's say I bought my books with a bank, with a $500 bank draft, and I had some left over. Are there any rules or in the policy that prohibit like putting it into a on-campus account with the bookstore to use for future purpose, for future purchases for other semesters?
It's my understanding that that money is to be used for your books and supplies. So I would suggest, I'm not sure how much money you're talking about, but if there's some supplies that you need to have to continue your education from that bookstore, that they be purchased. Does anybody know about setting up an account with the bookstore? We got some hands going.
Yeah.
Kind of see those hands waving. Okay.
I will speak to that.
Great.
At San Francisco State, they would do that for me if I had extra money. Usually it wouldn't be good from semester to semester, or it wouldn't be around from semester to semester because I'd end up using it on supplies. But I would assume that, I mean, I would have I would have assumed that it probably wouldn't be good from semester to semester anyway, because you usually have to get allotments based on your need from semester to semester anyway. So,
does anybody else have a comment?
Yes, we have one person back here.
Hi, this is Therese. I think we need to be very, we need to take note. We need to make sure we're not talking authorization versus bank draft.
Yeah.
And that's really, that's important, because it's my understanding, and again, just like Joe was saying, even we as counselors get all wild with all these rules and stuff because we're not attorneys. Sure. But it's my understanding with a bank draft, I would bring my bank draft to the bookstore. My bank draft might be for $500. I get book A, B, C, and D. Oh, it's $275. Well, that leaves a balance. But the bookstore takes my bank draft, cashes it in like a check, and that's all it's good for. But if I use an authorization, okay, I can do that, and then it's kind of there for the semester in case I need more additional books and supplies. So I think we need to be sure we're talking the same orange, right, not two apples or something.
So basically, Therese, then I'm saying that if you see that your bank draft is for $500 and you only need $275 for those textbooks, and there are supplies that you need to have for that semester, then get them at that time, and then you've used your bank draft. If you need additional funds later for other textbooks, contact your counselor.
And also, I think this is a different school by school, because I'm not going to say the names, but when I was young, when I go into this 4-year university,
I want to know.
Actually, it was a bank draft. It was a bank draft. They kind of put in leftover on my account, so I can use for this money for next semester. However, just a few years ago, the other school didn't. They say they told me they can. So I think this is really different school by school.
Right. Sandy Handy. Also, I have a school that won't even take our authorizations. And on the bank draft, it specifically says how much for books and how much for supplies. So the school, the bookstore, will only let them get the $25 towards supplies. So if those, let's say it was that situation that was $275, they still would only be allowed to spend $25 on the supplies.
Yeah, I experienced that as a student, and I guess, like, I had a physical ed class, so they did allow me to buy sweats as, like, because they had to see my, the classes I was enrolled in. Right. So, you can maybe buy a pair of sweats for your class. Anybody else?
Yeah, but no swimming suits and no, you know.
You can get swimming trunks.
I know.
You'd
be surprised what I've seen come across on those receipts. I go, whoa. Just kind of throwing that out there. Make sure it's a required class and that it's really required for that class.
And that it's towards the goal.
Thank you. That's another part. It should be a part of your academic plan.
Yeah, I had one consumer that every semester she wanted to take dance or basket weaving or whatever, and she wanted me to buy all the supplies for it. And I said, you know, you've already done your electives, so I can't do anymore.
Anybody else in the audience? Okay, next question. Are you?
We done? Any more questions?
You said you have some interesting questions.
I think somebody
already did them. I think we already did the questions.
So, if I could just make a couple of comments. Are you going to close, Linda?
First of all, I want to thank everyone for coming. Particularly want to thank Joe and Catherine and Tricia and their deep bench, Bennett and Sandy and Therese, for answering all these questions so well. And and thank everyone for posing questions. I think we have a lot of work to do, and that Blind Students of California has some good direction that we can put our energy as well. So Joe would like to make some closing remarks.
I think it's really, I'm very, very happy to be here and to hear the questions and have the dialogue. I think that it's this kind of environment, this kind of dialogue that really allows us to look at what we're doing and ask ourselves the question of, are we doing the right thing, or do we need to look at it differently? So I appreciate the opportunity one, to, so thank you, Donna, for reaching out and asking, and two, for inviting us to be here. The other thing is, as you move forward and you have these kinds of questions, you have a lot of good people around you. You know, Donna's been very active with this, and artists, and Gene. Every time I come to the students forum, I always see them involved. So thank you for that. But don't hesitate to bring those forward. And really, the other thing that I think is very important here, you're at the beginning of your careers. As you're going through this and you're seeing experiences, we benefit from hearing from that. We benefit from hearing about your experiences, whether they're positive or not so positive, because it's that kind of input that allows us to continue to check back in and see, are we doing it, and are we doing it right? So thank you, and great convention.
Yeah.
Keep it up. Excellent. Thank you.